Hey folks, so our speaker today is Wayne Hayes. He fell into a trap. I was having a little bit of an email exchange with him and he sounded interesting, so the seminar came along. So there we go. Wayne's a Canadian from having done his undergraduate and PhD in Toronto. And then he's working in Altera, a number of institutes, a faculty position at Irvine. PhD students, but is on a fellowship at Imperial at the moment, and actually has lined up another stint at Oxford in a year's time. So he's in our orbit, and I hope we're in yours. It's a little bit unusual talk for us, but nevertheless, I hope it's interesting. It's about processing images of galaxies.
Right, thank you. Yeah, so my PhD is in computer science, but my undergraduate was in astrophysics, and this is a very cross-disciplinary talk. I've given it both to astronomers and to computer science people, and I aim it a little bit differently depending on who the audience is. So I'm just curious, have any actual astronomers shown up for this? Wow, okay, great. Well, actually, that's kind of bad. That means I can't lie about the astronomy. Damn. Okay, so the collaborators here, really 90% of the work, the real work, was done by Darren Davis. He's my graduate student at UC Irvine, who's implemented most of this stuff. Eric Mjolstis is a guy who works, among other things, on grammars that we'll talk about a little bit later in the talk. And Aaron Barth is an astronomer, an observational astronomer at UCI, who keeps us honest with the astronomy. So a very brief outline of my talk. The basic idea is that, as our astronomers know here, simulations of galaxies and cosmologies are extremely detailed these days, handling lots and lots of different types of physics and done to high resolution, and make very detailed predictions, which are mostly verified by observations and some. I'll get to that later. Also, we have tons of image data that could be used to corroborate predictions of particular types of shapes of galaxies. The problem is that image analysis is not all that advanced. I mean automated image analysis. Humans can do it, and I'll talk briefly about the Galaxy Zoo project, but they will be overwhelmed by the amount of data that's going to be coming down the pipeline for astronomers in the next decade or so. So all of my talks have what I call a Tarzan summary, and the Tarzan summary of this talk is simulation's good, image analysis bad, and we're trying to fix that. And we have some encouraging preliminary results. So just to make sure we're all on the same page here, I want to remind you how science works, since a lot of you being computer scientists might forget what you learned in high school. And the basic idea is, you know, you observe some phenomenon and you wonder how it works. Then your task is to create a hypothesis which tries to explain the phenomenon. Basically, it's a prediction, perhaps based on currently known theory, perhaps based on new theory. Then you have to carefully design an experiment to test your hypothesis. Then you have to carefully perform the experiment to test the hypothesis. And quite often your prediction is wrong, and in which case you say, oops, and you go back to the top. You might want to try a different theory or create a new one. That's a very popular trend these days in physics. If you can't figure something out, create a new theory. On the other hand, if your prediction is actually correct, then that's good news, great. Now you want to go back and hone the details of your theory, perhaps make your prediction more accurate. So, for example, that's exactly what happened with gravity, right? Newtonian gravity came along, and for 200 years it did a great job of explaining almost everything that we could see in the sky until Mercury came along and wasn't moving quite right, and relativity had to be, I won't say invented, but relativity came along to help explain the anomalies that Newtonian gravity couldn't. Now, a slight variation on that is how modern astrophysics works, with apologies to the astronomers in the audience. And what astronomers do is they basically point their telescope at the sky and they say, gosh, I wonder how that works, right? And they wonder about what they see. Then they'll often write some kind of computer simulation to model the phenomenon that they've seen. They'll extract predictions from the simulation. They'll compare the predictions to the observations. They'll change the model until the simulation comes out about right and gets about the same thing that we see in the sky. In order to do that, you can do many things. You can increase the precision in several different ways in a simulation. You can simply use a higher resolution. For example, you can use more particles in a gravity simulation. You can use a shorter time step for your numerical integration. You could add more physics, like gravity, gas, dust, magnetism, radiation, general relativity, quantum effects, whatever you need, whatever you want to throw into your model and make it actually give the right answer. And occasionally, the observational astronomers will come along with new observations and throw a wrench into everything, and you have to go back to the drawing board. So that's modern astrophysics. Here's a really simple example of that process at work. This is a real picture of two real galaxies called the MICE. And the reason they're called the MICE is because, well, you know, at least one of them looks kind of like a mouse. Here's the body of the mouse. Here's the tail of the mouse. Here's another mouse with, you know, at least one tail. And the idea is, I mean, it looks like these galaxies are interacting in some way, right? They're close to each other. There's a weird shape. There's even a bridge here of material, visible material between them. The question we'd like to answer is, you know, how did these galaxies actually get this shape? Where does the shape come from? And to answer that question, we can go ask John Dubinsky of the University of Toronto, who actually writes big galaxy simulations. And he wrote a really cool galaxy simulation that models the MICE. So this is, we'll look slightly better if the lights are off, but don't worry about it. This is an actual simulation of, I think about 100 million particles are in this simulation. It's a collision of two galaxies. And the goal of this particular simulation was to, again, see if we can reproduce the shape of the MICE. And it took John, he tells me, an extraordinarily extraordinary amount of effort to actually get the details right. So the kinds of things he had to change, I'm going to stop it right about here. In order to get this right, he had to play with all sorts of variables, like the initial positions of the two galaxies, the initial orientations of the two galaxies, their initial velocities towards each other, their initial shapes, all sorts of things he had to play with, and the viewing angle, of course, right? You know, where's the Earth? Where are we viewing this from? All sorts of parameters he had to play with to get it right, and now you can see that at this point, this particular picture here looks a little bit like the real picture. Let's bring up the real picture at the same time. The real picture of the MICE, right? We're kind of, you know, we've kind of got the same kind of structure. We have the two blobs here. We have the tail that's going out. We have another tail over here. It's a reasonably good approximation of what we're seeing here. So we can say that, okay, now we kind of understand what's happening with the MICE here. It's a collision of two galaxies about a billion or so years in process. There's a few minor anomalies. Like, for example, you might notice that in the real MICE here, the tail is fairly bright, whereas in here, the tail is fairly dim. That's because in the real universe, there's new stars being formed here by the violent throwing together of gas and dust that was in the galaxies, whereas this galaxy here only models particles with gravity. There's no gas or dust or new stars being formed. And the brightness here basically just models the density of matter. So we're not really seeing, you know, starlight here. We're just tracing density of matter. It's kind of fun to watch this simulation continue and see what happens in over the next few billion years. What happens is the two cores come together again and collide again, and you get a train wreck of stars being thrown all over the place. And astronomers actually use that term, train wreck, in describing these kinds of galactic mergers. So this is called a merger. And what you get, basically, you know, you start off with two beautiful-looking spiral galaxies, and you end up with a train wreck that's basically looks kind of like what astronomers call an elliptical galaxy. You get one galaxy which is kind of dense in the center, and stuff, being spewed all over the place. Where are we? Right. So using the high school scientific method, we've basically managed to explain the shape of the MICE. That's good. So I'm going to show you some other recent cool simulations done by astronomers. The one I just showed you now uses gravity only. And I want to show you another movie that also uses gravity only, but it's a simulation of many galaxies all colliding. So this is supposed to represent an initial condition. Let me just run through it once. It runs much more quickly than the previous one, with lots more galaxies merging, eventually resulting in what's called galactic cannibalism. This galaxy in the center basically eats most of the stuff that comes too close to it. And this simulation was meant to show kind of what happens over the age of the universe when you if you assume that you start off with a universe that's mostly small spiral galaxies, but in the modern day universe, we see a lot of things in the sky that look like this, right? There's a huge elliptical galaxy surrounded by smaller galaxies, and we'd like to understand how that process works. And this simulation was designed let's just watch it one more time. It's kind of cool. Now, this simulation, again, also only models gravity, including dark matter. There's a lot of matter here that's modeled. About 90% of the matter is not actually shown here. That's why it's called dark. But anyway, so this galaxy, again, only models gravity. Now, the problem is the universe contains a lot more than gravity. So you can also do simulations that add gas and dust and charged particles and magnetic fields and something called inverse Compton scattering. And I'm going to show you that movie now. This talk is almost all movies, actually only for about the next 2 minutes. Then we'll get into something more substantial. So this is a simulation done at the Max Planck Institute for I think it's theoretical astrophysics, it's called. And although you don't see much moving here, there is actually stuff happening here. If you look here, you'll see that things are kind of slowly colliding together. This is the same kind of simulation that I just showed you a minute ago, except at a much larger scale. So rather than simulating only one galaxy cluster forming, we're simulating a substantial fraction of the universe, and we're seeing many different clusters of galaxies all forming and collapsing together. So here's, for example, here's a big merger happening, and here's some more mergers happening all down here. So this is just the matter, the gravity, but this particular simulation also includes gas and gas density, gas temperature, gas shocks. So the shocks here are what form new stars, and two different types of energy here that I don't want to get into the details of. It's called inverse Compton scattering, but the details don't matter. The point I'm trying to make here, aside from showing you very pretty pictures that will hopefully keep you awake, is that we can do very detailed simulations of the universe and make very detailed predictions about many things in the universe. And the simulations are extremely detailed and realistic, closely matching observations in many ways. We can reproduce the large-scale cosmological structure and understand how it came about. We can predict dark matter distributions and also visible matter distributions fairly well, gas and dust distribution and temperatures, elemental abundances. You know, why is the universe, I forget the number, if the astronomers can correct me, the universe is like 75% hydrogen and something like 20% helium and 5 or 10% other stuff, which is what we're made of. So we understand what those elemental abundances came from now, star formation remains, dynamics, X-rays. Lots of things can be explained by the simulations that astronomers do and comparing them with observations. So you might say, well, you know, what am I doing? What am I standing here talking about? What's missing? And I claim that shape is what's missing. And a general statement that you can make is that the generation of spatial form is not well understood. And that's not just in astrophysics. It's also in many other branches of science, like plants and shapes of clouds and landforms like mountains and river valleys and coastlines. Understanding how those shapes come about is not really well understood yet. And I'll make one brief note that if you're familiar with fractal geometry, you might know that we can actually generate pictures now using cool fractal geometry of things that look a lot like mountains and clouds and coastlines and trees and river valleys. But fractal geometry just describes those shapes and helps you generate pictures of those shapes. But fractal geometry makes no claim towards explaining how those shapes arrive in nature, whereas generally our goal in science is to understand how things work, not just be able to describe pictures of them. Conversely, actually, what I'm going to be talking about here is mostly just about the shape, so keep that in mind. So now let's actually get on to some pictures of what galaxies look like. Galaxies come in all shapes and sizes. Here we have some face-on spirals. Here we have an edge-on spiral galaxy. Here we have something that is kind of like an elliptical galaxy, but not quite. It's a kind of a weird galaxy. Here, if we just look at spiral galaxies that are mostly face-on, there's a lot of different kinds of structure, right? You can have big, bright cores. You can have small cores. You can have lots of arms. You can have just a few arms. Here is an example of what's called a barred spiral. Here's another barred spiral, but it's quite a bit different. These two barred spirals are quite a bit different from each other. Here we have two galaxies that are interacting, seem to be interacting in some way with this bridge of material between them. So there's lots of, you know, galaxies come in all shapes and sizes, and so you know, understanding these particular shapes is not well understood, especially if you talk statistically. You know, how many galaxies have different kinds of shapes? That's not well understood. So here is throwing up some ideas. Why do we actually care about the shapes of galaxies? And my claim is that in those big detailed simulations I just showed you, there are lots of implicit predictions on shape there in those simulations. Right? Those simulations are 3D simulations of particles and gas and dust all flying around. And you know, when you evolve those simulations up to the present day and stop them, you could, in principle, look at the shapes of galaxies and things that are in those simulations and extract detailed predictions. On the other hand, images of real galaxies, you know, just like the pictures of real galaxies that I just showed you, show that shape can be used to test the above predictions. The problem is that image analysis, at least especially shape analysis, is a very difficult problem that has not been solved in almost any area of computer vision. I just heard that Facebook somehow has some very good facial recognition software working, but it hasn't been published yet. So the kind of questions we'd like to ask or potentially even answer by comparing simulations of galaxies to real galaxy images, for example, astronomers might have a better idea of what kind of questions to ask, but just off the top of my head, what fraction of galaxies are spiral versus elliptical? In spirals, how many arms are there? How thick are those arms? What are the brightness profiles of those arms? What are the pitch angles? So pitch angle just basically measures the tightness of the winding of the spiral arms, right? You know, here's a galaxy with very tightly wound arms. This one here has slightly less tightly wound. This one here is not tightly wound at all. And that's described by what's called the pitch angle of the arms. And finally, from a cosmological context, how do all of these numbers change as the universe ages? Because we definitely know that the universe changes the way it looks a lot from when it's young until it's older now. And another really, really basic fundamental question that we could ask is, does the universe as a whole have angular momentum zero or not? Right? If you go back far enough towards the Big Bang and look at the universe just a fraction of a second after the Big Bang, it was about the size of a grapefruit. And if the universe as a whole does not have angular momentum zero, that grapefruit was spinning at an enormously high rate. Just like, you know, you've all seen the figure skaters that start spinning like this, and as they pull their arms in, they spin faster. Well, that's the result of angular momentum conservation. If the universe is spinning at all right now, then when it was small, it was spinning very quickly, and that has enormous cosmological implications for Big Bang theory. We could actually try to answer this question simply by looking at spiral galaxies in the sky and counting how many of the galaxies have arms winding clockwise versus how many of them wind counterclockwise. And if that answer is they both, you know, statistically speaking, there's an equal number of both, then we can say with some error that the universe has angular momentum zero within some error bar. And the larger the sample we have, and the more accurately we can measure the angular momentum of galaxies, the more tight of a bound we can put on that question. We can't answer this question because there doesn't exist a computer vision algorithm that can look at millions of galaxies and even determine which way the arms wind. So let's talk about some of the data sets that we're going to be drowning in soon. The Sloan Survey actually already exists. I think it was finished about 10 years ago. And it has about 1 million galaxies in it. The Large Synoptic Survey Telescope is currently under construction in Chile. And its task is to map the entire sky over and over and over again. And it's going to produce about 30 terabytes of data every night. And the Joint Dark Energy Mission is currently proposed, not yet even funded. But the idea there is also to repeatedly map much of the sky from orbit at a resolution comparable to the Hubble Space Telescope. So the way the Hubble Space Telescope works right now is if you're an astronomer and you want to look at something, you put in a proposal saying, you know, I'd like to have this much time to look at object X. I think the Joint Dark Energy Mission will almost make that obsolete because they're just going to map the entire sky over and over and over again. So if you want to know what galaxy X looks like, you just go and look at the most recent scan and find out what galaxy X looked like last week from the Joint Dark Energy Mission. Let me actually show you what kind of the Joint Dark Energy Mission will see if it's ever actually launched. It's going to see something similar to what the Hubble Ultra Deep Field shows us. the Hubble Ultra Deep Field was taken in 2004, and the basic idea was this. Let's go find the darkest, blackest patch of nothingness that we can find in the sky and point the Hubble telescope there and leave it there for 12 days. 12-day exposure of nothing. What's there? Well, it turns out that there's actually quite a bit of stuff there. A whole bunch of galaxies. You can see that, you know, here's a beautiful spiral galaxy. There's also some weird blobs of things, a couple of elliptical galaxies, a couple of random stars that are probably in our galaxy. You know, just blobs, you know, lots of stuff in a patch that looks like absolutely nothing from the ground. So it turns out if you count them, there's about 10,000 galaxies in that image, and they're all from the very young universe, about 12 or 13 billion years ago, only about a billion years after the Big Bang. That image comprises about 1/13 millionth of the entire sky. It's about 1/50th the size of the full moon. So do the math. 10 to the 4th galaxies, 10 to the minus 7th of the sky. So do the math, and there are 10 to the 11th such galaxies observable from the Earth, from orbit, across the entire sky. And and also just kind of note the universe. Our universe is mostly spiral and irregular galaxies. There are not very many ellipticals. That's in stark contrast to the nearby universe, which is the modern universe, where there's lots of large ellipticals. This is, you know, this here is what the Joint Dark Energy Mission will see, but multiplied by about 10 million. Okay, so there's lots of shape to be had in the observable universe, but nobody even tries to predict things like arm counts or shape from their simulations. And my question is, why aren't we looking at millions of galaxy shapes in the sky and comparing them to the shapes that can be extracted implicitly, could be explicitly extracted from our simulations? If you happen to be in computer vision, you already know the answer. Say it with me. Computer vision is hard. Right? It's a very hard problem. So there's no point in making predictions because there doesn't exist any hard data to test the predictions even statistically. Okay? And that's the problem we're trying to solve. Turns out vision is really easy for humans, and to demonstrate that, I'm going to give you a little test. On the next slide, there's going to be two galaxies. One of them has lots of arms, and the other one has a very few number of arms. I want you to tell me which one is which, and I'm going to give you 1 second to do it. Everybody ready? Time's up. So, how many of you thought the left galaxy had more arms? Left is this side, right? How many of you thought this one had more arms? How many of you thought the one on the right had more arms? Everybody, excellent, great. Turns out you're all hired. Security's locked the doors. I just got about a billion pounds from EPSRC, and you're all hired into my new galaxy recognition project. You're going to be spending the rest of your lives classifying galaxies for me. Actually, that's a lie. It won't get funded because it already exists. It's called the Galaxy Zoo. The Galaxy Zoo is a website where you can go and waste as much time as you want classifying images by eye by clicking buttons on a website, right? Now, how many arms does this galaxy have? Well, does it have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? Is it a spiral? Is it an elliptical? Is it edge on? How big is the core? Does it have dust lanes? Is it elliptical or not? You can spend an enormous amount of time. After about 10 minutes of training, the average 12-year-old can classify galaxies better than any computer algorithm can. This is great. I mean, there's lots of useful information coming from the Galaxy Zoo project. The problem is that 150,000 12-year-olds isn't enough for 10 to the 11th galaxies. You know, do the math, it's about 500,000 galaxies per 12-year-old. They'll get bored before that. And furthermore, humans are not very good at objective quantitative measurement, right? So you can ask a 12-year-old, how many arms do you see? But if you ask a 12-year-old to measure the pitch angles of the arms, they'll go back to their video games or go play outside or something, right? They'll get bored. So we need something automated to solve this problem. Okay. Turns out there are methods to model computer programs to model galaxy shapes. One of the better ones is called GalFit, written by Chen Ping, who's Canadian, at the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory. Here is a picture of a real galaxy called M51. Here is GalFit's model of M51. And you can see, at least at the level of gross large structure, it does a fairly good job. This is just a subtraction of the two images. The problem is that GalFit is not at all automated. Now, I'm curious, any of you astronomers, anyone actually use GalFit? How long would it take you to, if you were given from scratch, to create that model of M51 using GalFit? Right. So I asked Aaron Barth, my astronomy collaborator at UCI, and he said it would take him at least hours, probably several days of fiddling with the parameters. So it's not at all automated yet, and it would be very difficult to automate. So even though it works very well and gives us a lot of information about a galaxy, it's not appropriate for even 10,000 galaxies, much less 10 to the 11th galaxies. And Chen Ping has a sense of humor. So if GalFit can't find if your parameters don't fit very well, it gives you an ASCII mushroom cloud. Astronomers do have a sense of humor. So our approach is many faceted. One of the things we use are called dynamical grammars, and I'll explain what those are in a minute. Dynamical grammars are really cool in the sense that they're basically absolutely anything that you can model on a computer, you can fit into a dynamical grammar. And that goes from everything from plant growth to weather to galaxy simulations. And I'll give you an example in a second. We have a program that will do galaxy image normalization. This is not particularly new or fancy. Astronomers even know how to do that. We use what's called a Huff transform to find arms and discern winding direction. And I'm not going to read through all this. I'll show you the details on the next slide, next few slides. So for those of you who are astronomers and might not know what a grammar is, let me give you a really simple example of a grammar. This grammar is going to be used to describe a string, just a string of characters, okay? This particular grammar has two what are called production rules. The string S can be either empty, the empty string, the null set, or it can start with an A, end with a B, and have a similarly recursively defined string in the center. Okay? So if you stare at that for a while, you'll realize, soon realize, that the strings defined by this grammar are of the following form. They consist of a bunch of A's followed by exactly the same number of B's. Okay? Those are the only kind of strings allowed or defined by this grammar. Now, given a random string, or given a particular string, the act of deciding if a string satisfies a certain grammar is called parsing. And this is exactly what your Fortran or C or Java compiler does when you write a computer program. It parses your program and figures out if the string of ASCII characters that you typed in or not are actually syntactically correct in that language. The opposite of parsing is called generation. You can choose, given a grammar, you could choose to kind of what I call run it backwards and use the rules to randomly follow rules to randomly generate syntactically correct strings. And if you've ever marked an undergraduate computer assignment, you might think that, I think that actually this is what some of my students use to generate their programming solutions. So randomly generating syntactically correct strings at random can be done. Okay? Here's a more sophisticated grammar. It defines a galaxy. This is called a dynamical grammar. And this is actually a snapshot of exactly the syntax we use in the language called Plenum, which was developed at UCI. It's implemented under Mathematica. And this particular grammar defines a very simple model of a galaxy. And I should have rearranged the order of my slides here, but let me first show you the blue curve here and the green curve here represents a two-armed model spiral galaxy. Okay, so and that's what the grammar on a previous slide defines. So just remember, a two-armed model is the model that this grammar is defining. So let's read through it. A spiral galaxy at position x consists of a bulge, which is the center of the galaxy, at position x, and what's called an arm generator rule. Okay, so the arm generator is not a real arm; it's a rule that generates arms. It says with probability 1. There we go. With probability 1. Okay, so every galaxy contains a bulge and an arm generator. The arm generator rule generates arms, as the name implies. So an arm generator at position x consists of two arms, both starting at position x, and they start with initial angles. They're emanating from the bulge at opposite angles. So those are angle theta and theta 0 plus pi. So the two arms emanate from the bulge just in opposite directions. And their initial length is 0. That's what these two zeros represent, the initial length of the arm. And we can also actually generate multiple pairs of arms by recursively calling our arm generator rule here with some random distributions that don't matter. an individual arm starting at position x and currently at angle theta and currently traveling at angle theta and currently of length r is actually defined by a continuous differential equation where, so arm of x theta r becomes arm of x theta r by continuously solving. The length of the arm is increasing at some constant rate k, and the angle is also changing at some constant rate s. Okay, and this, keep in mind that this t variable is not t in the sense of, you know, real time in a galaxy evolving. It's just a parameter variable that defines arms emanating out from the center of the galaxy. We're trying to describe shape here, not evolution. Finally, an individual arm becomes nothing, or i.e. it ends, the arm stops, with some constant probability. So the length of the arm is also stochastic. Okay, and that exact grammar there generates model galaxies that look like this, right? So the blue line and the green line. We have more general grammars, much more complicated grammars that I'm not going to show you, that can be used to generate more complicated looking galaxies. And here are some samples of the model galaxies that we can generate using plenum and some more sophisticated grammars. Now, what we really want to do is we want to take an image of a real galaxy and parse it, right? Just like a computer program like a compiler parses a computer program, we want to parse a galaxy image. And to do that, we use a standard machine learning algorithm called the EM algorithm, expectation maximization. And so we've taken this picture of a real galaxy, and we've turned it into a monochrome image. And the blue line and the green line represent an initial random two-armed model. And our goal is to fit that model to the actual image. And we've colored the pixels here red and purple because what we're trying to do is we're trying to decide which pixels belong to which arm. So a person would say this arm is one piece and on the other side is this arm is one piece. We want to see if we can classify the pixels. Here, initially, with the initial guess, not surprisingly, we're wrong. Like, for example, these pixels, purple pixels here, should probably be colored red. But once we've actually fit the galaxy to the model, or fit the model to the galaxy, we've done a much better job, right? All the purple pixels belong to one arm and all the red pixels belong to another arm. Okay, so we've done a relatively good job now here of fitting the grammar-generated model to the image. The problem with grammars is that they're actually quite expensive, and fitting this kind of model to an image, the time required to do that grows exponentially with the number of parameters, so it turns out that grammars are a bit too difficult, too time-consuming, too CPU-intensive to actually use for more complicated pictures, so we had to come up with some ad hoc methods. Let me just very briefly mention that we can do something that the astronomers also can already do, which is basically, you know, given a galaxy and a random Gaussian model, we can make that Gaussian model fit the galaxy so we can find the center and estimate the radius that encloses the galaxy. And we can also do what's called standardizing the image, which means flattening it out so it becomes circular. That'll be important later on. So now, what is there anything that we can do that astronomers can't do besides that simple two-armed? Oh, and the other problem with this model here is it's just too simple, right? Galaxies consist of more than just two arms and a bulge. So what can we do that astronomers can't do yet? Well, we can use, there's a very, almost a textbook technique called the Hough transform in computer vision. And without giving you any details, the Hough transform is basically a fairly efficient and reliable way for finding lines in an image, right? So if you have a random image and there happen to be things lined up in that image that are lined up in a linear fashion, the Hough transform is good at finding lines, the line-finding algorithm, that's all it is. How can we use that? Well, if we take this picture of a real galaxy, and we're going to look at the galaxy in polar coordinates. So we find the center, and on the previous slide I showed you how we can find the center. And of course, you know, polar coordinates are just, you know, r and theta, right? So you can describe the pixels, the points in these images using r and theta. But we're going to plot r and theta actually in a Cartesian coordinate system. So this plot here is take r and theta from this image and plot it in a Cartesian coordinate system. So the vertical axis is r, the distance from the center, and the horizontal axis is theta from 0 to 2 pi. And this image here is basically a transformed version of this image right here. It's exactly the same image, just transformed. Now we can apply the Huff transform to this image, and lo and behold, spirals in this image look almost like straight lines in this transformation. So we're using the Huff transform, we can find the lines, and you can see that the Huff transform, it finds a line here, it finds a line here, it finds a line there. And so already one thing we can, and by determining whether the slopes of these lines are predominantly positive or predominantly negative, we can discern the winding direction of the arm. So we've already done something that nobody else can do, just using a very textbook transformation called the Huff transform. Okay, so that's the first new thing that we can. And we can also, by you know, finding the most prominent lines, we can get an estimate of the number of arms as well, and even their pitch angles by measuring these slopes. And here's just what the Huff transform looked like when you transform it back into regular coordinates. We have spirals that roughly follow the arms. There's other information we might want to extract from pictures of spiral galaxies, and to do that, I'm going to describe another algorithm to you. How am I doing for time? Oh, we started quarter after, so I have until quarter after again. Right, okay, we're fine. So, Kinmin Au and his advisors published in 2006 a cool method of using what's called texture analysis to extract what they call an orientation field from a random image, like a galaxy image. So an orientation field just basically means the way you get it is, for example, you slap down a bunch of vertical black lines on this image. And between the lines, by reading between the lines, you can find the parts of the image that are images that are kind of aligned vertically, right? So here's a part of the image that's aligned vertically. Here's another part of the image that's aligned vertically. Here, also another one. Do the same thing horizontally. So you slap down a bunch of black lines horizontally across the image, and you can extract which parts of the image are roughly horizontally aligned, like here or here. And do that for a bunch of other angles with black lines. And you can extract what's called an orientation field. So this here, it's not a vector field. There's no, you know, we don't distinguish between left and right. It's just orientation. So this picture here represents the orientation field that we have extracted from this picture of M51. Now, they went and used this orientation field to fit a simple model of a barred spiral with two arms to a bunch of galaxy images, and you can see that they've done a reasonably good job. I'm not quite sure that I would say there's a bar there, but this one definitely has a bar, and they've found the arms fairly well. They almost always get the winding direction correct in their fits, and they applied it to about 300 galaxies, but these ones here represent kind of the best sample, right, the best-looking ones. A lot of the other ones just don't fit as well, and furthermore, it's a relatively restricted domain, right? We're assuming a two-armed spiral galaxy with a bar, and even that isn't enough to describe things. You know, for example, you know, there's no bar here, although there are two arms, but there are plenty of galaxies that don't have two arms. So we wanted to extend this work to something more general. So what we did is we applied a relatively simple clustering algorithm. So we take a picture of a galaxy, we produce a contrast-enhanced version of that galaxy, and then, so I forgot to mention back here, this orientation field allows us to assign each pixel in the image an orientation. Okay, so every single pixel in the image is given an orientation from this orientation field. And then what we do is we cluster the pixels according to their orientation field. Relatively simple algorithm to do that. So, you know, this clustering here has nothing to do with brightness. It has to do with orientation. We're clustering the pixels according to their orientation. And you can see now that we've done a relatively good job here of tracing out the arms, right? So this arm here kind of forks halfway in between, and it's a kind of a toss-up whether you'd want to say that the arm goes this way or that way after it forks, but... and also here, for example, a human would probably classify this as one arm rather than two. But there's some post-processing that we can also do as well to merge things later on that obviously appear to be one arm rather than two. But you can see we've done a fairly good job here of extracting what we might call arm segments, right? Especially out here where there's just, you know, kind of almost a train wreck of stuff. We've extracted the linear-like structures from the image. Once we have these clustered arm segments, or once we've isolated arm segments, we can now perform fits of curves to each of those clusters. So astronomers already know or assume that spiral arms follow a particular kind of curve called a logarithmic spiral curve. And so we simply perform a least squares fit of a logarithmic spiral curve to the pixels in each cluster, and that allows us to pull out pitch angles from the arms here. Now I want to show you, because the results are changing so fast because Darren is such a productive graduate student, I want to show you our most recent results, and they change every week. So here is we have 8 galaxies in our sample of a relatively small sample right now of galaxies we're actually trying to fit. So this is obviously a barred spiral of some sort. This here is the fit that we get. So we I didn't describe how it works, but we also have a bar extraction algorithm. So we've detected that there is a bar here, and these lines represent the fits through each of the arm segments. We're at the point now that we should probably start figuring out how to merge things, right? So these curves here are currently all separate, but we should probably merge that all into one arm. But that's currently work in progress. And finally, if we superimpose the fitted curves onto the original image of the galaxy, we again see that we've done a pretty good job of tracing out the arms. Red corresponds to arms that are winding, that we measure as winding clockwise. Blue corresponds to parts that appear to be winding counterclockwise. And if we simply add up the lengths of all the red curves versus all the blue curves, we can say that this spiral galaxy predominantly winds clockwise, which is the right answer. Here's another galaxy. It's actually the one we just looked at that has an arm forking off here. And here we've done a bit better of a job now of tracing out one arm and recognizing that the fork is a separate arm. And you know, we're extracting arm segments here relatively well. I'll go quickly through. Oh, and here's what it looks like if you put it on the original image. And again, this is predominantly a clockwise spiral. And we have lots more samples. I'll just blow through them very quickly. And you can see that we're doing a fairly good job of extracting. Even in the cases of galaxies that are kind of messy, we're doing a reasonably good job of extracting the structure from them. Okay? So I'll stop before everyone falls asleep. So we're almost at the end of my talk here. Right now, what I've been showing you is bits and pieces that we're currently working on. We already have results that as far as I'm aware, go far beyond what anyone else has been able to do in automatically parsing structure in face-on spiral galaxies. But it's just bits and pieces. It's work in progress. We have to tie it all together. Perhaps we'll probably get back to using grammars to tie things together. We won't use the grammars for the fits, but we'll use grammars to tie things together in the end, or perhaps some other high-level tool. And that's it. Thank you.
Microphone is for the recording, so please take it.
So I've got a basic, what might be a naive question about your grammars.
Okay.
So I'm used to using grammars for natural languages, and your grammars looked a little bit different. So I just wonder, can you ask questions about the generative capacity of the grammars and that sort of thing, in terms of the sort of languages that they define? Is that a sensible question to ask?
It's probably a sensible question, but to tell you the truth, I'm not an expert in grammars. I'm just using Plenum for this particular application. So I'm more familiar with how Plenum can be used to simulate physical systems, whether they're, or at least model physical things. So one of the other things that Plenum is used for is modeling the growth of what's called the meristem of the Arabidopsis plant, right? So if you took a microscope and look at the tip of a plant growing, there's stem cells that come in the center and they fall off the edges and they differentiate into various types of cells. Again, it's a physical system that you could model as a computer simulation. And the claim is that Plenum can be used to model almost any kind of physical system that you can simulate on a computer. That's what Plenum is designed for, and that's what I'm more familiar with. So no, I'm not very familiar with how Plenum could be used for natural languages. questions from the astronomers? So actually, I have a question for the astronomers. Is you know, I'm not a real astronomer myself. I have some astronomical background, but what I would like to hear from the astronomers, and you don't have to answer this question right now, but I'd like astronomers to think about it. What sort of information would astronomers like to see extracted from these images? Right, right now we're pulling out, you know, whether there's a bar, what the arms look like, what are their pitch angles. So I asked this very same question at an astronomy meeting a few weeks ago, and the next day an astronomer came up to me and said, well, you know, one thing that is really closely tied to theory, gravitational theory, is asymmetry in a disk. So in some contexts, the disk of a galaxy is unstable, and that manifests itself by asymmetry. So you can actually, even this galaxy here is a little bit asymmetrical, right? There's kind of more stuff on the right than there is on the left. I would have never thought of that, but he said, you know, if you can extract from your images some measure of asymmetry, that would help us understand galaxies better. So that's the kind of thing I'd like to hear, what other kinds of interesting information. So if you have any ideas, either tell me now or get in contact with me later, because I want to know from the real scientists what information you'd like to see out of these images.
I've got a question. You're trying to fit these models onto visual manifestations, and I've no idea whether they represent the real world or not. They're visual things, which I can see from a graphics point of view. So how do you fit in the theory, the physics, the boundaries, or any other constraints or guidance which doesn't come from these observations but from some other theoretical basis to generate things that don't quite match this, but are closer to understanding of reality than this sort of matching?
So let me try and restate your question and tell me if I'm on the right track. Are you kind of asking how will these observations connect to the theory?
I'm trying to ask, very naive question, does the theory match these visual observations?
Oh, we don't know yet. I mean,
and then as you're fitting this onto the visual observations, how much difference would it make if you took some theory into account of how particles behave, and say, well, I can't have a spiral like this for this gap that I'm missing. It must be something else. And actually, you won't match the image particularly precisely, but you'll have a better...
Right. So the thing that you described in the last sentence was what I would call a theory-laden observation, right? So if you make an observation and try to constrain it by the theory, you might want to do that, but I think it's a little bit too early in the process right now. I mean, astronomers are really good at having the observationalists talk to the theorists and try to hash out what's happening. Although when I'm wearing a different hat, sometimes I'm kind of doing theory of astronomy. In this particular project, I'm trying to look at it totally observationally without any theory-laden observations. So I would imagine that at some point a few years from now, if we can start extracting information, then, I mean, as I said at the beginning of the talk, theorists aren't even thinking really too much about the shape. So
going one stage further and saying there's some common ground between the theory of on the astronomy side and the theory of parsing, and there's overlap, and you actually enhance the observation in a constructive way as a result of that,
right,
rather
so
than just making
so what
it
you're
a
saying, yeah, right,
graphical
right.
best fit onto an image in the pure pixel bashing sense. That's a pipe dream, is it?
Maybe let me try to rephrase your question again. So you're saying if we have a grammar, is that yes. going to constrain the try to constrain the observation? The answer is yes.
How does it relate to the theory of what you're observing?
Well, this grammar is a lot more related to simply, you know, look. I mean, so we have images of tens of thousands or even millions of galaxies, and astronomers just basically look at them. So right now, all classification, with the exception of things like Galfit, is done by eye, right? So for example, one of the most recent PhD students graduated from the University of Toronto. She spent 4 years classifying 14,000 galaxies by eye twice, just to make sure that she got the same answer both times, right? And that was her entire PhD, and her...
Well, you have dedicated PhD students in astronomy.
So, but the stated goal of that project was, first of all, to try to figure out what are the parameters that we need to identify in classifying galaxies, and second of all, to provide a large database created by a learned astronomer to be used for testing automatic classification algorithms. So, since I'm from the University of Toronto, I know the advisor of this student, and we talked when I was there a couple of weeks ago, and so we're going to start working together testing our algorithms against this student's classification. But still, that's all done by eye, right? So it's purely a visual classification. We don't try to constrain that classification by any gravitational theory or anything else. Someone had a question?
So you're right now doing only face-on?
Face-on or almost face-on. Yeah.
So maybe a suggestion. If you have a database of already classified, categorized galaxies, then you can, and you suddenly have a non-face-on galaxy, you will see that it doesn't, this model, this particular parsed thing, doesn't match anything we have in the database. So it must be tilted, or it must be, I don't know, do you do something like that? Do you?
Well, I mean, we can fairly easily detect things like this, right? This is not a face-on spiral galaxy. And plus, I mean, galaxies come in all... there's exactly face-on to almost exactly edge-on and everywhere in between. If a galaxy is edge-on like this, there's not much we can do with it. So right now we're just looking at things that are almost edge-on or at most maybe a 45-degree tilt. And it's fairly easy to detect, you know, how elliptical is the two-dimensional shape. And if it's too elliptical, just throw it away. So we are focusing mostly on face-on spirals, partly because that's the hardest problem, right? I mean, if it's edge-on, it's just a line with a bulge in the center, right? It looks like an LP with a hamburger in the middle. So the face-on spirals are the hard problem, really.
Sorry, just a question and a comment. So the comment is that we've actually used a lot of the Sloan galaxies, the Galaxy Zoo galaxies, and we've done classifications using artificial neural networks.
Oh, cool.
And we were able to reproduce the Galaxy Zoo classifications for more than 90% of the galaxies, so the human classifications.
Is that published yet?
That's published, yeah.
Oh, when?
So it should be in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society Journal.
Oh,
but it's online. It's online, okay. So I can give you the link if you want.
I love it. Yeah. How recent is that?
So it was...
I'm slapping myself for not... If it's very recent,
It's well, it appeared on the web in end of 2009, probably.
Okay.
But we did artificial neural network classifications for all the Galaxy Zoo objects.
Sure, I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah,
So the question I have, though, is can you... I mean, our goal here is to be able to extract quantitative information, right?
Right.
So like pitch angles and stuff.
Right.
So reproducing what the Galaxy Zoo did is a very good start.
Yeah.
But can you extract pitch angles at all?
Well, no, we haven't tried to do that. So our first sort of aim was just to classify things as elliptical, spirals, and irregular systems, and just to see if we could do that using the parameters that the Sloan Digital Sky Survey measures, and we can. The question that I had was, how sensitive is your classification algorithm to the resolution of the images? Because obviously with next generation surveys like LSST, like JDEM, the resolution is a big issue because we're going to look at really faint galaxies.
Right.
So how sensitive is this sort of clustering analysis that you're doing to the resolution?
That's an excellent question. There's several different sensitivities. One of them is just simply compute time. The larger the image, the longer it takes us to classify, because first of all, there's more detail, and second of all, our algorithms just scale as a number of pixels, right? So if you have an n by n image, then it takes about n squared time for us. So for a nearby galaxy, which you know is a 512 by 512 image, our algorithm could take a couple of hours just to extract the arms, and even the Huff transform also takes time n squared. We can go down to a resolution of about 64 by 64 pixels, and at that point, the classification or the algorithms take about 5 minutes to run, so it's much much faster. But below that, actually, the orientation field computation actually requires the orientation field actually requires at least 64 by 64 pixels. So below that, so we're looking for other ways to get the orientation field. So, I mean, a lot of, you may be familiar, I mean, obviously you are, that the Sloan Sky Survey has about a million galaxies in it, but the number of ones that have really easily identifiable structure is only about, I think, about 15,000. And those are the galaxies that Preethi is her name, this graduate student in Toronto. Those are the ones that she visually classified. Those are the only ones that have enough structure to, you know, have some meaningful classification done to them. The rest of the almost million galaxies are just too low resolution to have any structure, any significant structure visible. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah.
But I'd certainly like to hear more about your neural network classification.
Okay, Wayne, thank you very much. It's great. Makes a change to have a seminar like this in the computer lab. And all you astronomers are very welcome. Come again. We don't bite very much.